Today is Thursday, January 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump tries to dial down tensions with Iran as lawmakers question justification for a military strike on a top Iranian general.
Our great American forces are prepared for anything. Iran appears to be standing down.
The mystery of why a Boeing jetliner crashed and killing all 176 people on board shortly after takeoff from Tehran. Also ahead, Billie Eilish continues to be on fire, now up for even more music awards. It's all on today's International Edition. U.S. President Donald Trump may have narrowly escaped immersing the U.S. in a broader war with Iran, at least for now, after his order to kill a top Iranian general sparked a crisis and prompted criticism at home and abroad. There are reports that as Iranian missiles rained down on bases housing U.S. troops in Iraq, there was a sense of foreboding Tuesday night at the White House. But there was minimal damage and no casualties, which could have created further U.S. retribution. On Wednesday morning, Trump gave a televised address where he seemed relieved and also announced further sanctions planned for Iran.
As we continue to evaluate options in response to Iranian aggression, the United States will immediately impose additional punishing economic sanctions on the Iranian regime. These powerful sanctions will remain until Iran changes its behavior.
But even members of his own party seem concerned at the strategy, including close ally Republican Senator Rand Paul.
I think sanctions have actually pushed Iran away from the negotiating table and made it less likely to have a diplomatic solution. At this point, there are so many sanctions on Iran, I don't know what else we could do to actually increase them.
But even holding a news conference after Congress was briefed by White House officials on justification for the U.S. strike against Iran, Senator Mike Lee, another Republican, was not satisfied with the briefing or the explanation.
Now, I understand these are busy people. They've got a lot of demands on their time. They're appearing before a coordinate branch of government, a coordinate branch of government responsible for their funding, for their confirmation, for any approval of any military action they might undertake. And they had to leave after 75 minutes while they're in the process of telling us that we need to be good little boys and girls and run along and not debate this.
Lee said being told not to debate or discuss the reasoning behind the military strike of this magnitude goes against what Congress has taken an oath to do.
I find this insulting and demeaning, not personally, but to the office that each of the 100 senators in this building happens to hold. I find it insulting and I find it demeaning to the Constitution of the United States, to which we've all sworn an oath.
Joining us now to talk more about the latest developments is Robert Deitz, professor of governmental affairs and policy at George Mason University. Thank you for being with us. So what do you make of the members of the president's own party criticizing the administration's handling of the matter?
I think one of the problems Senator Lee and I suspect others are having is that the foundation of Trump's foreign policy when he ran for president was America first. What are we doing all over the Middle East? What is the threat to us? Why do we care? And let's forget about nation building and all that. Let's worry about America. So what we have is the president ordering the assassination, the killing of a very senior Iranian general. And it seems to me the candidate Trump would really have asked President Trump, what's the connection to America first? What's the threat he's providing toward the U.S.? And I think that's the problem these senators are having. The term of imminent threat is, it's sort of almost a term of art, meaning we really had to act right away. I haven't seen anything in the press that seems to suggest what that imminent threat was.
Does this, as the administration said, make us safer?
Very hard to see for me to see how it makes us safer. Certainly there are better and less good generals. There are no doubt are bad generals around, but killing a general, you know, no matter how bad you think he is, that is to say how evil you think he is, killing a general doesn't really make much of a dent in terms of creating security.
What about the actions Iran took on Tuesday night with apparently it was 11 missiles targeting base where American troops were being hosted in Iraq. No Americans were killed. There are some that are saying that this was intentional, that Iran did not want to kill, but to just basically send a warning shot. Do you think that's the case, or did they just miss?
I do not think it was deliberate in the sense that the rocketry has gotten much, much better. No country can assure that rockets land where they're aiming, but avoid taking the lives of any particular individual. So that's nonsense. But I do think that this was Iran saying, we're going to respond in a measured way. Take the hint, don't escalate.
It seemed by the president's statements that this crisis is basically calmer. Iran standing down. Does that sound like Iran? Would Iran really be done with their revenge if they did not achieve any fatalities in retaliation for this person that they revered?
I think you're asking an unknowable question, at least unknowable to anybody in this country. I suspect that we've not heard the end of Iranian aggression against America. But certainly, I think what Iran was trying to do was to say, look, we're not going to lie down and play dead. But at the same time, we're not going to get carried away and try to do enormous damage. So I think it's Iran saying, you walk away, you did what you think you had to do. We got our revenge, at least as we can pass it off to the Iranian people, and let's stand down.
Certainly with the U.S. sending thousands of troops to the Middle East, it would sound like there are at least some concerns that this may not be over.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, American troops, as powerful as our military is, when you've got troops spread across a large geography, as American troops are in the Middle East, they're vulnerable. And Iran has enough influence in the region and enough of its own force that it can exact revenge on a much larger scale. But there's also, of course, the question of what can be done to American assets, for example, in this country or in Europe or elsewhere in the world.
What about the fact that the U.S. did not give allies a heads up about the dangerous action that it was about to take, which could have very easily put their own personnel directly at risk?
I don't like our sort of unilateral approach to foreign policy. We've worked for years with our European allies. They trust us, or at least trusted us, and we usually kept them seriously in the loop on this. And I think that we end up paying a price for this unilateral activity, in part because if things go wrong, we can't embrace and say, look, we all decided this. NATO and all our allies, we all agreed upon this, which, as you know, President Bush and President Obama often used. You know, we collectively made a decision. By going it alone, if things turn south, the Europeans can say, hey, don't look at us. We had nothing to do with it. We weren't even aware of it.
A lot of analysts are saying that the decision by the United States to eliminate, take out this man was really done without consideration for the fallout in the region and the wide-reaching impact it could have. Do you agree with that? And if so, what do you see?
I don't know. I mean, you know, people who've opposed military action in the Middle East always say something like, all this is doing is creating a next generation of terrorists. Yeah, maybe yes, maybe no. I think it's very hard to conclude anything about that.
And what about the nuclear issue? Iran was complying with the nuclear deal. The president pulled out of that 2 years ago.
Yep.
And now it's escalated to the point where Iran says it will not comply at all and will start ramping up its nuclear program again.
That is the most serious repercussion so far of Mr. Trump's decision to pull out of that arrangement, because there's no question that Iran can build a nuclear weapon, and its rocketry has improved to the point that it can probably have a reliable means of transporting it to various countries around the Middle East and perhaps even in Europe that it finds threatening. And I think that's the biggest danger that Mr. Trump's actions have created.
Robert Deitz, professor of governmental affairs and policy at George Mason University. Meanwhile, President Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu discussed critical bilateral and regional issues in a call on Wednesday, though no details were provided on the substance of the call. Still, Netanyahu did publicly praise Trump.
President Trump should be congratulated for acting swiftly, boldly, and resolutely against this terrorist-in-chief.
Well, Iran has threatened that any further retaliation by the U.S. could make Israel a target. Joining us now is Rabbi Terry Bookman, author of the new book, Beyond Survival, How Judaism Can Thrive in the 21st Century. Thank you so much for being with us. What do you make of everything that's transpired and people on edge in Israel?
Yeah, and I think that's one of the reasons why the Iran nuclear deal was created, and it was really created with at the behest of Israel, especially because Israel understands that a nuclear-armed Iran is truly an existential threat. There are no other existential threats to the existence of the state of Israel but a nuclear-armed Iran. And again, it's important that we try to, I know that the Americans especially have very short-term history-itis, but it's really important to understand this in a larger context of the Middle East. The Middle East has been facing this kind of battle for more than 4,000 years, where different ethnic groups have tried for hegemony over the Middle East. Today, Iran, which represents the old Persian ethnicity, even though they're all Muslims, is the most powerful nation in the Middle East, and it has proxies now in four different countries, and it strives for even greater control. Israel is a buffer against that, and of course the Gulf states are a buffer against that. Egypt, to some extent, is a buffer against that. But this is in the context of a longstanding fight for who's going to be the number one power in the Middle East.
Why is America so deeply and heavily involved?
I would say that it has a lot to do with, or most to do with, oil, and secondarily with values. We are a democracy that values freedom and democracy throughout the world. Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East, and so it is a natural ally for the United States, and the Gulf states supply the oil. I mean, if you could imagine, if we could imagine that all of the world got off fossil fuels, they only had renewable energy, I think that the Middle East would become less relevant to most nations around the world. They care less about the Middle East at this point in time. But since that's not the case, and that means that we have to maintain the Gulf states as well as Israel as allies, and that's why America is involved.
What is your biggest concern about this whole situation that has been unfolding in the past week?
My biggest concern is that, while imperfect, we had a pretty good deal with Iran vis-a-vis its pursuit of nuclear weapons, and now that may be off the table. And that is a concern. I think it should be a concern for not just for Israel and the United States and the Gulf states, but for the entire world. The denuclearization of the world is in the best interest of everybody. More nuclear-armed states raises the risk of nuclear proliferation and nuclear accidents or war, and that's really, really dangerous. So I would hope that we could get back to some sort of deal with that, which means that in a deal, every side gives up something, and the United States gave up a lot of the control over the monies that were no longer flowing to Iran. Iran is trying to have greater and greater control, and it uses proxies, which are also dangerous, but not nearly as dangerous as a nuclear-armed Iran.
All right, Rabbi Terry Bookman, he is the author of the new book, Beyond Survival, How Judaism Can Thrive in the 21st Century. Democratic presidential contender Joe Biden described President Donald Trump as dangerously incompetent on Tuesday for the targeted killing of Iranian military commander Qasem Soleimani. Biden and his Democratic rivals have been heavily critical of the president's decision and have warned about the consequences. We get more now from VOA national correspondent Jim Malone.
Speaking in New York, Joe Biden lashed out at the president with a lengthy critique about the consequences of the attack that killed Qasem Soleimani.
President Trump has no strategy here, it seems to me. He has no end game. And here's the hardest truth of all. His constant mistakes and poor decision-making have left us, the United States, with a severely limited slate of options for how to move forward.
Biden contrasted Trump's approach in Iran with the more diplomatic approach carried out by the Obama administration. And Biden also urged the president to seek congressional authority on the use of military force.
You're required to work with Congress, Mr. President. You're required to abide by the War Powers Resolution, Mr. President. And you cannot pursue war with Iran without consent and authority from Congress.
Even Biden's rivals for the Democratic presidential nomination have also been quick to criticize Trump, including Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders.
The role of the United States, difficult though it may be, must be to work with the international community to end conflicts, to end the threat of war, not to promote war, as President Trump is doing.
Senator Amy Klobuchar, another contender, also expressed concern.
And I am very concerned that this president used disproportionate force and made a decision that is going to trigger an escalation of the conflict.
Democratic candidate and former South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg addressed the attack during a town hall in Iowa.
Being in a leadership role around the world doesn't mean throwing military force at every problem out there. It means using every tool in the toolkit, diplomatic, economic, social, informational, and when absolutely necessary, military, to try to make sure that our interests are protected and that values we share with the entire human race are upheld and promoted around the world.
At the White House Tuesday, President Trump again defended his decision on Soleimani.
He's been called a monster, and he was a monster. And he's no longer a monster. He's dead. And that's a good thing for a lot of countries.
The focus on Iran comes as the Democratic primary campaign heats up just weeks before the first votes are cast in the Iowa presidential caucuses on February 3rd. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. As we heard, Joe Biden is lashing out at Trump over his, what he calls, dangerously incompetent killing in Iran or in Iraq. Suspense grows over a possible John Bolton, former National Security Advisor, impeachment testimony. Why are new foreign students veering away from the U.S.? And plastic bags and fur coats. New York is welcoming new bans in 2020. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. A Ukrainian airliner fell to earth in a fireball shortly after takeoff from Tehran Wednesday, killing all 175 people on board in a crash that has sparked an international scramble to establish a cause. The Ukraine International Airlines Boeing 737-800 en route to Kiev and carrying mostly Iranians and Iranian-Canadians crashed hours after Iran fired missiles at bases housing U.S. forces in Iraq, leading some to speculate that the plane may have been hit. Reuters reporter Libby Hogan has more.
A Ukrainian Boeing 737 crashed after takeoff in Iran Wednesday, carrying 176 people. All aboard were killed, according to Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky. Grim footage from Iranian TV showed debris, smoking metal scrap, and rescue workers with face masks retrieving bodies. Officials and Iranian state TV say the plane had technical problems soon after leaving Tehran's Imam Khomeini Airport. The plane crashed near the airport and burst into flames. The flight tracking service Flight Radar 24 showed the plane was flight PS752 bound for Ukraine's capital, Kiev. Iranian state media quoting a local aviation official said the pilot did not declare an emergency. Iranian rescue workers have reported they've now found one of the two black boxes of the crashed airliner. The airline said it's doing everything possible to find out more details about the cause of the crash. The site says the plane was 3 years old and was a 737NG jet. Wednesday's crash could pile into Boeing's safety crisis. It's been grappling with two deadly crashes involving another jet, the 737 MAX. Boeing grounded its 737 MAX fleet worldwide last March. The crash also happened within hours of missile strikes launched from Iran at U.S.-led forces in Iraq.
Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said Wednesday that Canada expects to play a big role in the probe of this airliner crash that killed 63 Canadians, even though the two nations don't have diplomatic ties.
At least 63 Canadians were on board, and a total of 138 passengers on that flight were connecting to Canada. All people who won't be coming home to their parents their friends, their colleagues, or their family.
Most of the victims came from Canada's Iranian community. Among the dead were a newlywed couple that had traveled to Iran to get married, as well as two professors of the University of Alberta. The disaster marked one of the greatest losses of Canadian life in a single day in recent years. Well, the World Meteorological Organization is warning Australians should brace themselves for a protracted summer of catastrophic bushfires. The WMO says there is no doubt that climate change is playing a role in the country's drought and damaging fires. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Australia's summer fire season usually begins in late January or early February. This time it got off to an early and catastrophic start in September in the states of Queensland and New South Wales. The bushfires have killed more than 22 people, destroyed hundreds of homes, burned large swathes of land, and caused massive devastation to wildlife, ecosystems, and the environment. The World Meteorological Organization warns the current fire season is likely to be unusually long and challenging, with the potential for further catastrophic outcomes. WMO spokeswoman Claire Nullis says naturally occurring climate variability is playing a role in these unprecedented events. She says another driver is a phenomenon called the Indian Ocean Dipole, which was very strong last year.
And that has the effect of making Australia drier. It has the effect of making East Africa wetter, which is why we saw the floods in East Africa. So on the one hand, you do have the natural climate variability. On the other hand, climate change is playing a role, and we should be in no doubt about that.
A report by the Australian Bureau of Meteorology says climate change is causing temperatures to rise and contributing to long-term increase in extreme fire weather. It says December 19th was the hottest day on record, with an average temperature of 49.9 degrees centigrade recorded at Nullarbor in South Australia. Nullis says Australia's bushfires have far-reaching consequences.
The fires have led to hazardous air quality, which is a threat to human health, in major cities in Australia, spreading to New Zealand, and sent smoke drifting thousands of kilometres across the Pacific to South America. And NOAA satellites sent out a tweet that the smoke is in the process of circumnavigating the planet.
WMO scientists warn wildfires harm the global climate by emitting carbon dioxide. They say forest loss leads to the reduced uptake of CO2 from the atmosphere, further fostering climate change. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And you're listening to International Edition. Stay with us. We'll be back in a minute.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Prozac Nation, the author, Elizabeth Wurtzel, she wrote the best-selling memoir. She died at the age of 52 after a long battle with cancer. Her blunt and painful confessions of struggles with addiction and depression made her a voice and a target for an anxious generation. In her book, Wurtzel wrote about growing up in a home torn apart by divorce and spending her adolescence in a storm of tears, drugs, bad love affairs, and family fights.
People tend to describe it as incredible darkness, and I think that's just the best way. I mean, anybody who thinks that it's something to hold on to, or that there's something romantic about it, or something interesting about it, that's just crazy. It's just a bad thing that you want out of your life as quickly as possible so that you can move on and do other things. What makes people talented, or what makes people capable of doing great things, is that they're gifted. It's not that they feel bad. You have to think of it as a disease and not a state of mind. Because it really is a disease. There's great medication, methods of therapy to cure it. There's so much you can do to help yourself now.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA called on Dr. Stephen Mall, a medical expert from the University of North Carolina, to help treat an astronaut aboard the International Space Station. The astronaut had developed a deep vein thrombosis, or blood clot, in his jugular vein. The biggest concern of this condition is that part of the clot could break off and travel to the lungs, where it could cause a pulmonary embolism. Since it wasn't possible to send Dr. Mall to the ISS to treat the person, he began his evaluation and treatment procedure from his office at UNC. Dr. Mall and NASA doctors decided the best way to treat their patient was with a regimen of blood-thinning drugs. While the supply of these drugs aboard the ISS was limited, it was enough to treat the astronaut until a supply ship delivered medications recommended by Dr. Mall that would successfully complete the treatment. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Singer Billie Eilish seems to be unstoppable. The accolades, awards, and recognition continue to pile up. As we hear now, the singer is leading the number of nominations for the 2020 iHeartRadio Music Awards with 7 nominations. She'll be competing for Female Artist of the Year and also for her song Bad Guy for Song of the Year against Lil Nas X and Lizzo, who both have 6 nominations each. The awards broadcast live from the Shrine Auditorium in Los Angeles on March 29th. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Calvin Fowler. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Bate, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And Our 5 minutes newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.